Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. I am so excited. The snow has stopped, finally. And it's beautiful outside. And we have a great show for you. Actually, we have a great show. And I'm looking at my thing over here. And this is ridiculous. We have Matt Coyle here, and he wrote the novel Blood Truth, and it's a fantastic novel, and I'm going to let him tell you about it. How did you, good morning, how are you today?
Good morning.
Let's see if I can get
you.
This done. How did you create Rick Cahill? How did you create Rick Cahill? And what's the backstory about him and his father that,
I first started writing the first book, Yesterday's Echo, man, a long time ago. It was probably about 15 years ago. And it took me, I think, 11 years to get it published with many, many revisions. And the book stays all, I think, first book started out, particularly in first person, they're a little too autobiographical. So with each revision, thankfully, I moved away from my life into a fictional life. But the way Rick sort of, the way I really got my hands around Rick was when I was revising an early edition, and out of the ether, I'll say, this, the line came to me, which became the first line of the book, which is the first time I saw her, she made me remember and she made me forget. Mm-hmm. And from that, I realized that this character was a lot darker than I've been writing him, and there was something very dark in his past that I had to discover, and there was also the need for him to find some joy in life. And once I got that, his backstory really filled in for me, and I had a character that I learned more about each time I write a book.
Yeah, I know. I like this character. So
thank
how
you.
Come he was kicked out of the police force, and so was his father? How come? What happened?
Well, his father, obviously years before him, when Rick was, I think, 9 or 10, his father worked for a fictionalized police force, La Jolla Police Force, which is a town in San Diego. And the question is, why was he kicked off the force? And there was never, the truth never came out. And the rumors, as when Rick was a child and throughout his life, were that his father was connected up with the mob and had gone from being a very respected cop for the La Jolla Police Department to this pariah who was kicked off the force without a pension, had spiraled into an alcoholic and died at a young age when Rick was only sophomore or freshman in college. And so that, Rick's own cloud of being, he was later in life, he was suspected of murdering his wife when he was a cop up in Santa Barbara. And he was arrested for the crime, but never went on trial. He was released, but not exonerated. So even to this day, he remains a suspect. So he had his own baggage carrying around, and he had his father's baggage when he goes back to San Diego or La Jolla to deal with whenever he has to go up against the La Jolla police force. They always have, they not only think this is a guy who got away with murder, but his father had his, his baggage. So Rick carries that around, and in this book, he actually discovers the truth about what happened with his father.
I know. This was really, I have read, I can't even imagine, I think it's over a couple of thousand, seriously, books in the last 7 years? Oh, seriously, it's scary. And this one was original because everything is just about ordinary murder. And I said, this was really interesting because it had, DNA and all that stuff. And when I get something that's more interesting, I just sit down and get eye strain and read it, which is what happened, which is really, that's a good thing. So,
thank you.
At the start of the novel, we learn that his father died, and he finds a safe. What's the significance of the safe that he finds when he's going through his stuff?
As the book opens, he arrives at the house he grew up in and hadn't been back in 18 years after his father's funeral. And the new owners, his mother had sold the house to a family right after his father died, and she moved with her new husband to Phoenix in Arizona. And so the house is now, it's been with this other second family's, been in there, they've owned it and lived there, and then they sold it to a new developer, I guess, or a flipper who's going to flip the house. And in tearing the house down to his studs, he finds this compartment in the room that Rick knew was his father's den, a room that he was never allowed in. Nobody was ever allowed in. Mm. And so the family lived there after Rick's family didn't even know there was this hidden compartment in the wall. And there was a safe there. So this guy, the new owner, gets a hold of Rick through his mother and says, "Hey, I found this safe. Do you want it?" And this is all sort of backstory. And Rick, knowing that the safe was in his father's den, a den that he actually snuck into one time when he found his dad's keys while he was at work, mm-hmm. and he came across a ledger, not in the safe, he didn't know about the safe, but he came across this ledger as a kid. He didn't really know what it was, but later in life he figured out this is probably keeps track of the money my dad took from the mob. So he has that, and then when he finally gets the safe open, he finds something that leads him along another clue to find that gets involved in a long-time cold murder, cold case murder, and that leads to some answers for Rick and some trouble for him, of course.
Well, how does it open from the start? This starts a chain of events, this particular safe. How does he get it open? That was original, too. Like, how are you going to get this thing open? Because he can't do it.
Yeah, it's got the old in the first chapter, he mentions that he has been paid out of safes before because he's a private investigator, mm-hmm. and he's been paid cash, and they all have the safes he's familiar with now have the digital dials, of course, but this, being older, like 25 years or so, has the dial, you know, the round dials where you click it. And so he tried everything he could think of. He tried his father's birthday. He tried his birthday, his mom's birthday, their marriage date, what have you. And he can't get the thing open. So he takes it to a store for a guy who sells safes, and he drills it open. There's a way to drill it. Drills it open for him, and then Rick opens up and finds some stuff in there.
We found some interesting stuff that we won't say is in there. And then we get a phone call from Kim Parker.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
When we find out we have another part of the plot there. That's the first part of the plot, what's in the safe and what it means and all that. Then we have his ex-girlfriend called. That was so cool. His ex-girlfriend called, and what does she need his help for?
She's only been married for a couple of years to a real estate mogul. Or he's not really a mogul. He's the biggest real estate agent in San Diego. So, and he handles very high price. His agency specializes in very high price homes in La Jolla, which is a very wealthy enclave. This is a woman, the first woman he really loved since his wife died 13 or so years ago, but of course he's a little messed up in the head, so even though he really loved this woman, he could never fully commit to her, and so she couldn't wait around forever, and she takes her second choice, this realtor, and only, I think, less than 2 years into the marriage, she thinks that he might be having an affair, and her new husband might be having an affair, so she goes to Rick, because he's a PI, and she thinks he'll be, handle it delicately, and of course he doesn't really want to get involved, because first of all, he realizes he's still carrying a torch for Kim, and he thinks it might be a little messy, but she gets upset because she feels like she has no place else to go, and so he helps her because she's doing something for a friend. He can't turn his back on a friend. And what he finds out becomes a lot darker than just potentially an affair going on with her husband.
Well, he thinks so. He goes there and he sees this Sophia Domingo. That's the one he thinks he's having the affair with. So he sees whatever, and he sees him go in, and then it takes him a while to get out. I can't believe he didn't have any fun, really. Give me a break. So and then this other guy comes, Peter Stone. So what does he want with her? This girl's awfully popular. I don't know.
Well, she's attractive. Peter Stone is actually a nemesis out of Rick's past, and he's he thinks from what he's seen through his surveillance of Rick and this Sophia that she's had, that they are having an affair. And so he has, and he's upset about it because this is, even though down the line it could actually work his benefit because maybe he could get back with his ex-girlfriend who in seeing her again, he realized how deep his feelings still are. But he's still a bit of a human being and he cares about that this will make her unhappy, that she's having, her husband's having an affair. So he's sitting there in his car kind of going over things in his head and he sees, he's been surveilling a high-end hotel in Pacific Beach, which is near La Jolla. And he's about to take off, and he sees this Peter Stone pull into the park in the garage of the hotel. And he figures, he knows that Peter Stone, and he's had some, in the first book, he and Stone have a very contentious relationship. And Stone is a former casino owner from Las Vegas, who had mob connections, but he's kind of redefined himself as a developer in San Diego and a philanthropist because he spends a lot of money and puts his name on a lot of buildings. So only those who really know him well realize how dark a guy he is, and because his face for the public is this guy who's very philanthropic. So when Rick sees him going to this hotel, he says, well, this can't be good. There must be something more to this. And he finds out that he does have a connection with Sophia Domingo, and things ensue.
Now, she goes, takes a suitcase, goes to this meeting of the Coastal Commission. Why?
Well, it's Rick, and when he sees Stone pull into the parking lot, or into the underground garage of this hotel, he follows him in there on foot, sees that Stone is carrying a briefcase, and later he sees that Sophia has his briefcase. And so Rick, knowing Stone, figures there's probably money in there, and there's probably some bad connection, and Rick ends up following Sophia to this Coastal Commission meeting where they're going to decide whether to allow the sale from UC San Diego of a huge slot of coastal land to these developers who have green connections. They're supposed to be very green, and then they're going to, as well as with their profits, supposedly build some lower income housing. And Rick sees that she's connected with Stone, and that she has some influence over this commission, where it would seem like this would be a vote that would not go in the developer's favor. It does go in their favor, and so he figures that yes, there is a deep connection between Stone, and who benefits from the development, and Sophia. And then how does this? That makes him question how Kim's husband, Peter Jeffrey Parker, is involved.
Yeah, how is he involved? We're not going to tell everybody everything. So, we have another character who's very, very elusive, and we'll just touch on her very gently. She's a lobbyist, and her name is Dina Durkin. So, what does she need her help? What does she need Sophia for? And you get the impression that they swing both ways at one point. I got that. You see, I got it.
Well, there is, I stole from, well, I can't say that, actually. There is a line that when they meet, I don't want to give away too much, but there is a connection between Sophia and Dina on various levels. And Dina Durkin is very influential in with the Coastal Commission. She's a lobbyist, but she's has a lot of connections, and Sophia wants to benefit from those connections.
I could imagine. So what happens when Kim learns her husband might be up to, and she reacts to what Rick tells her? How does she react to knowing that maybe she's right, and then again, you never know?
Well, she reacts like I think anybody would. She's upset, and a little bit of that upset gets flushed onto Rick, which he understands because he's been in this game for a while. He's he's sort of his specialty. Unfortunately for him, he'd rather do more interesting and less dirty things. But he's kind of he's the divorce specialist guy. He's the surveillance for cheating couples. That's how he made his money in his for the investigative agency he used to work for, and then he's off on his own, and he really has to make money where he can, and so people mm-hmm. tend to come with him for hey, I think my husband or wife is cheating on me. So he's used to the flashback, the brushback. When the truth comes out, people mm-hmm. get upset, but it makes it a little more doubly difficult for him when it's his former girlfriend, the woman he still cares very much about.
Well, let's go back to the other plot. I've got a lot of questions here. I must have been on the days I was just kept typing, people. So he finds something in the safe. Tell us about what he finds in the safe and what it does to connect to and why. And what does he think this proves about his father without giving away too much?
Well, yeah, I don't want to give away too much, but he finds a gun in the safe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a 25 caliber known as a Saturday Night Special, a gun that was, I won't go into the background of how why this gun came about, but it's known as a cheap handgun that Crooks use. And he's wondering, his father had plenty of guns when he was a kid growing up. Why would he have a gun like this? Why is it in the safe? Why is it missing two bullets? And he also, in the safe, there is a key to a safe deposit box. And he has to figure out where what bank has the safe deposit box and how to go through the machinations to be able to open it up. And once he does, he finds another clue that makes him think that his father, indeed, was hooked up to the mob in very... dangerous and lethal ways.
So what is this land deal that they want, Sophia Parker and Sloan, and how would this help Kim with her real estate agency? Because she had her own agenda.
Well, I don't want to give away too much on that one. It's Scripps Institute of San Diego is actually owned by UC San Diego, and so this would be Scripps is on the coast. It's on the beach, and it has a lot of land. And this swath of land would be worth billions. And to a real estate agent, if it's going to be a commercial real estate where they sell a house, the person who has the agency would have the rights to sell these houses would be worth hundreds of millions of dollars to the agency. And commissions.
Well, that sounds like something everyone would like to get into. Hundreds
sure.
of millions of dollars. Not bad, right?
Yeah.
Now we have another character that I really like. And I think Rick met his match with this one. Who is Moira, and why does he want her to help? And why does he pay her so much money? I don't get paid to do anything. Boy, that would be really great to get what she's getting just to help him out.
Well, Moira is a character that I, when did she start? In book two, Night Tremors, Rick takes a case. Oh, thank you. Rick takes a case where he ends up, unbeknownst to him, he ends up bumping another PI off the job. She'd been offered earlier, but the family really wants Rick. So when he decides the case, she gets bumped off the case. And she is pissed off about it, and she confronts him, and she ends up actually end up helping work the case later. And they thus becomes a very contentious relationship. I'll even call it a friendship. And so she appeared in the third book, Dark Fishers, briefly, just for a couple of phone calls. And the importance of Moira to Rick is that because of his father's relationship with La Jolla Police Department and his own history, where pretty much everyone thinks he's responsible for his wife's murder and got away from it. There was actually a 48 hours on it, and you know how those generally have a point of view. And
mm-hmm.
so pretty much anybody who's seen that show thinks Rick is a murderer and got away from it. So he doesn't have any connections with the other police departments when he needs help on a case or something, but Moira does. So Wappen contacts her if he needs a license plate run or something that the police that really shouldn't give private detectives may sometimes, and Moyer has connections, so he'll go to her when he needs something. So I needed her in the third book for just a couple scenes. And then I knew I needed her for one scene, the surveillance scene where Rick is surveilling the husband. And so I put her in the scene, and at the end of it, when she realized Rick's, even though they've finding that there is an affair, they think an affair is going on. That's, you know, they've done what they're supposed to. They've closed the case, but she sees that Rick is upset about it and doesn't realize that Rick had a connection to the woman who hired them. So a little bit of her goodness comes out because she's a tough character, Moira.
Mm-hmm.
But a little bit of her feelings show that Rick is indeed her friend. And when that came to me in this scene, I realized I needed her in the whole book. And to me, she was really the most enjoyable character to write in the book, and she's kind of, for me, the conscience of the book. And she's a huge part of it, where I never intended her to be in more than one scene. Important character, and she's, in the book I just turned in, the fifth book, she's has a, probably even a bigger role. So she kind of breaks on the scene on her own. Yeah, so I really like writing her. She has this kind of, they don't really have a romantic relationship. It's more of a big sister. She feels this guy Rick. He's a good guy, but he's kind of messed up in the head. He takes chances, and I need to help him. He knows that she's smarter than him and a better PI, so he uses her when he can. And in this case, you mentioned the paying. He doesn't want to take any money for helping Kim. He would feel badly if, you know, she's paying me. I found out her husband is probably having an affair. I've helped ruin her life, and I'm not going to keep the money, so I'm going to give it to Moira, who helped out.
I need a friend like that.
Yeah,
I know. She's good. I was going to ask if you bring her back. That's a good thing that you are. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Like I said, but before the show started, this book just showed up on my doorstep, and from Ocean View Publishing, and I'm going like, okay. And then I looked at it a couple of weeks ago, and I go, wait a minute, you've got to read this. It came out in December. What's wrong with you? I don't read, to be very honest, I don't read every one of them. It's like too many. But this one was like,
sure.
Oh, yeah, I got to read this. So what happens when Rick approaches Peter Stone, and why is this man so dangerous? And he threatens him every step of the way. If you do anything I tell you, don't tell, and if you don't do this my way, you're going to have a problem. How come?
Well, they have a history from the first book where actually, I'll give away one spoiler, Stone tried to kill Rick.
Mm.
But they have a Stone is actually now the partner in the restaurant with Rick's former best friend, Turk Muldoon. That was kind of a forced marriage that was going to go another way, that Rick interceded on Turk's part to make this strange but necessary marriage for these two people to own this restaurant. And so they sort of have a truce after, you try to kill somebody, but you overlook it after a couple of years. So they have a truce, and because Stone, despite being a very vicious purveyor of his own needs, he kind of respects Rick because Rick never backed down from him, and he's not a yes man, and he likes it. He respects Rick, and so they have. And there's a little secret that Rick has never taken advantage of against Stone. So they have a history, but things ensue in this book where they actually bump up against each other again beyond the hotel room that Rick sees Stone go into early in the book.
I wouldn't mess with this guy either. Oh, wow. Let me tell you. So let's get back to the other plot. Tell us what happens when he goes to the Windsor Bank and uses his safety deposit key and from his father's house, and he wants it open, and they don't want him to open it. How come? They gave him a hard time.
Well, there's regulations that, because I did my research on this. It's funny, generally when you do research, people are, you can't offer them any, you can't offer them any money. We don't make any money on these books, period. So you say, hey, this is what I can do for you. I will put your name in the acknowledgments, and I appreciate your help. And so the woman I talked to was very helpful, and the banking industry said, no, you can't put my name in anything. So this information they give you, I guess, is not supposed to be divulged, I guess, but it seemed pretty simple to me. I just had to learn what it would take if you are not the owner of the safe deposit box, even though it's a relative. It's kind of complicated. I had to find out a way for the safe deposit box to, even though the father's been dead for 18 years, I think, you know, 20, yeah, he's been dead for 18 years. But how can this safe deposit box still be opened in his name? Why wouldn't it, after he died, the bank has to divulge this information to the executor of the estate or the executor of the will, or, and no one takes the contents of the safe deposit box, the estate actually ends up with it, of course, the whatever the contents is and the value in there. So there had to be a reason. I had to find a way for the safe deposit box to be open all these years later, and I figured it out how to make it happen. But even so, with Rick, he's an heir to the dead man. There has to be, even though, because the safe deposit box is in two people's names, not just one. So there has to be a lot of legalities for Rick to go through to get. He has to get a death certificate from his father, which he ends up getting through his sister. So there's, here's the thing is that Rick likes to cut corners, and he's kind of pushing not being very nice to the bank manager because he wants to get this damn safe open, and she's making him jump through the hoops. So instead of going about it the easy way, he kind of makes an enemy, and he feels badly about it because he is a good guy at heart, and he flexes his muscles sometimes as a first choice as opposed to making friends, and when he's made life difficult for someone, he steps back and realizes that wasn't fair to this person. So that goes on. But there's also the owner of the bank has his own reasons for Rick not to get into the safe deposit box. But ultimately, legally, Rick does, and finds a couple of empty shell casings that would be the same caliber of the gun he found in the safe that was hidden in his father's den.
Well, I know about what you just talked about because when my sister died, I had to get into her safety deposit box to get my mom's jewelry. And my name was on the box, and hers is on the box. The one thing I do know for a fact is that you never tell them that the person's dead. Otherwise, they won't let you into the box. And my ex-brother-in-law, my ex-brother-in-law was there. I don't speak to him. So when my wife died, I said, no, she didn't. She's in the hospital, and we're waiting to see what happened. They will not allow you in to the box if the person's dead, even though my name was on the box, and I didn't have a death certificate with me because she had just died 2 days ago, 2 days before, and I had to get them. But I managed to convince them to let me get the stuff out because basically it wasn't. He was trying to get in there to see what was in there so he could take it, but I'm too smart. That wasn't going to happen. But, yeah, you can't tell them that the person is dead. If you want to get into a safety deposit box, when someone's gone, you just say, I'm the name on it, have your driver's license, and then go from there. I learned
I
all these things.
It doesn't make sense to me that your name was on the box. They wouldn't let you in.
Yeah, and I had my driver's license and stuff, but they said because she was dead, I didn't have her death certificate to prove that she couldn't get in there. I smiled really nicely. It was really good.
Rick should try smiling.
I try smile. It's hard to smile sometimes with this thing. So we have Trent Phillips and the woman that kept the, how come she kept the box open for so many years, this lady? Why did she do that?
I don't want to say.
Okay, we don't talk about that one. Okay, let me see what else. Okay, what happens?
Rick has to find out who this woman's name that's on the box.
Yeah, that's why I didn't say it.
Find out who she is and why the box was, why she would still have this box open. But anyway.
Okay, this question before that I'm going to leave out also because that would tell too much about the father. So what happens when Sophia disappears after her lunch date with Dina and Stone pays him to find her. I felt so
well,
bad for her.
Well, Stone has his reasons for wanting to find this Sophia. She's disappeared. Although Rick only knows she's disappeared because Stone has told her she's disappeared. And he has concerns that maybe Stone has killed her, but then he thinks, why would he kill her if he's trying to have me find her, unless he's trying to set me up or something. So with Stone, there's always these machinations. I think Rick at one point says that Rick's playing checkers while Stone is playing three-dimensional chess. So he can never quite keep up with him, but it always makes him wary. So Stone actually hires Rick to try to find this Sophia Domingo, and Rick enlists Moira's help also because, he always needs help. But he doesn't know why. He doesn't know why Stone wants to find her. And he says to himself, when he does find her, he's going to let her know that Stone's looking for her before he contacts Stone. See, Stone is holding over the fact that she met with Kim, Rick's ex-girlfriend, the woman whose husband's potentially having an affair. Stone says, well, if something's happened to this Sophia and Kim gets into trouble, you might need my help. So that's the reason Rick takes the case. And he takes the money because he doesn't mind taking money from Stone. He doesn't mind taking dirty money from Stone.
I don't mind either. Why not? So what happens when they find her and they decide to pin it on Jeffrey Potter? Why pin it on him?
Somebody has to end up dead in these books. And
I know. I felt so bad for her, the poor thing.
People can figure out who it is. Well, because Jeffrey has been lying about some things.
Mm-hmm.
He does not have an alibi. Even he says he's somewhere he really wasn't, so he doesn't have an alibi. So he becomes the main suspect in the disappearance of this woman.
So we're not going to tell too much. So Moira.
Nope.
And Rick get tear gassed. Why? There's another group here that wants to get rid of them, and I'm going like, oh my God, they can't win, these two.
Yeah, the tear gas research. I didn't actually tear gas myself, but I watched some stuff online, and pretty awful. Somebody's been surveilling Rick. And he thinks Stone's behind it. He doesn't know who's behind it. He's pretty sure it's Stone, because that's the kind of thing he'd do. And he tries to set a trap to get a hold of one of these guys and have him tell Rick and Moira, who helps out, who's working for you, who are you working for, and such. And, of course, it backfires horribly for Rick and poor Moira. He's along for the ride.
Well, we have Kim, and why does she keeps popping in and out. Why does she want to help him? Why does he want to help her? Seriously.
Why does Rick want to help Kim?
Yeah, why does he want to help any of them? I mean, really. He doesn't seem to be getting, he's gets stuck. He wants them to find Sophia, and she's, well, whoever. And she keeps popping back and forth, Kim. How come? Is she after Rick, too?
No, because he carries nothing if not guilt, and he feels badly about the way, about that he can never fully commit to her when she was fully committed to him. He's got this, even though before his wife died 13 years before, he has this idealized image of her, and even though they'd been having a really hard time at the time she was murdered, of course, years later, and if someone who's been killed and the first love, the deepest love of his life, now he sees his relationship with his ex, his former wife, and ideal size, where Kim Kim could never reach the same level of that Colleen was, his dead wife. And it's actually a pedestal that not even Colleen could ever reach, because that's how your brain works. So he feels badly about never being able to fully commit to Kim, that, you know, and she's kind of, you know, she's taken on this, she's with a guy who she's better than, according to Rick, and he feels badly about it, and he wants to help her in any way he can. And also there's, it turns out that she is pregnant, which complicates matters.
I know.
So when I started writing this book, I knew I was going to have two main plots as opposed to the main plot and then a subplot. I always have a very large subplot that involves Rick's background, some ghost for Rick. But in this one, the ghost for Rick was the main plot, and so I wanted to have something where he's, you know, he's doing his job as a PI. And so I made two main plots instead of a subplot. And in doing so, I didn't realize there was a connection between the two, but in writing it, it came about that Kim is pregnant. And so there's the theme of family. I don't write thematically, but sometimes things come up and it goes to, goes back to my kind of strange writing process where things kind of develop organically for me. I'm not a outliner. I do know where the ending is because I got to have a target, but along the way things happen and I let them envelop or develop. And if I have to change, if I have to go back and revise, I revise. It's a situation where I call dropping an anchor. Where with Kim, Rick's talking to her and he's deciding whether to take the case or not. And then she just drops, and I didn't even know this, I didn't plan this. She says she's pregnant. And so that gives a lot of more poignancy to the fact that her husband may be having an affair. She's about to have her first child. If this guy's cheating on me after 2 years, can I raise a family with him? So that makes it, you know, for Rick, there's more meaning to really helping her besides just his own selfishness, is she having an affair or not. But there's, you know, there's more involved in this than just the two of them. So anyway, the whole dropping an anchor thing, the way it works for me is that I'm writing something, I'm going along, writing a scene, and something may come out of the ether, just like the first sentence of the first book did. And I'll put it in there. Sometimes I don't know what it means. And I don't know if it's going to enrich the story, and I don't know if I'm going to keep it. And sometimes the true meaning of it will come to me later as I'm writing, and 90% of the time it makes the story better, richer, deeper, and my understanding of the story deeper. But sometimes I have to go back and pull up anchors. In this book, I didn't have to do that too much, and that's how the kind of the dual plot came about and the significance of the second, of the Kim plot, in that this is family. Rick's trying to find the answers to his childhood. And so, and then Kim's dealing with her own potential nightmarish family situation. That was long.
Yeah, well, she has to find the answers to herself, and I was surprised at her decision, but I'm not saying what it was. But yeah, and he has to come to grips with something, and she has to come to grips with whether she can stand being, you know, married to him or not. And maybe she needs to put a GPS on him. It might help her a little bit better to make sure, you know, where he is. And she can
earlier,
track him.
Yeah,
maybe. So
I recommend it for all marriages.
Yeah, that's so sad after 2 years. But then again, who knows whether he's going to still do it again, even if she stays with him. So not good. So tell us about the detectives on this case, and how come they don't like Rick? And tell us about Brickhouse. They don't like him at all. How come?
Well, the Brickhouse is called, it's the La Jolla Police Department. It's called the Brickhouse because it's made of brick, and it formerly was a library, and the cops all refer to it as Brickhouse, and Rick knew it as a Brickhouse when he was a kid because he used to go with the ride-alongs with his dad, who was a police officer there. Well, they don't like Rick because his father had dishonored the police department before Rick, and then Rick, who's this cop, he goes to Santa Barbara, and he's a cop up there, but he's a guy who everybody thinks got away with murder. So it's in their DNA not to like him, and it's in Rick's DNA not to move out of San Diego because he's made a home for himself despite all that's happened before him, and he's a stubborn guy. No one's going to No one's going to push him out of a place he thinks he owns. So there's one cop, Haley, can't even think of her last name. But anyway, he's had experiences with her before. So she carries a grudge against Rick. And then there's actually a new cop, Detective Sheets, that Rick hasn't dealt with before, who's actually pretty much down the middle with Rick. He's fair to him despite what his partner may tell him about Rick and his family. But this guy doesn't have the La Jolla legacy like the other cops do and like Rick has. He's fairly new to the force, and so he's going to make his own judgments. And Rick being Rick doesn't make it easy for him to be on his side. So, because Rick's idea of he's been interviewed by the police, we'll call it interviewed, in the white room with the white light a lot. And he's always protecting his clients and himself, so he only gives the cops, and he tries to be as truthful with the cops as he can, but only gives them as much information as he thinks they need, as opposed to the truth and nothing but the truth. So sometimes they figure that out, and they get angry with him. But he's always thinking, he kind of goes back to his father's, before his father, in Rick's mind, went bad, kind of the thing you live by, the ode you live by. Sometimes you have to do what's wrong, even when the law says it's right. And Rick has definitely taken that to heart.
Well,
so
what happens when
he has problems
you know,
with all kinds of authority?
Yeah, I know. What happens when Rick realizes that Sophia's gone? So, what are the chain of events when somebody is dead? That was interesting because they couldn't figure out what really happened to her.
The chain of events.
Yeah, when somebody, she was dead, they realized something, he realized something about, well, where she was found someplace, but what really happened to her? Oh, stomach.
Well, she was murdered. Well, her body was discovered after a few days of death and in a place that would point the finger at Jeffrey Parker, probably. So the police follow the pointed finger to Jeffrey Parker, and like I said, he doesn't have a good alibi. And so now Rick is in the situation, am I going to help this guy, when even though it might be better for me and my love life if he went away?
That's very true. So, let's see, who is Charlie Cahill, and why did the police deem him corrupt? And who did Rick want to talk to about what happened to his father, and why didn't the person want to talk to him?
Well, Charlie Cahill's his dad, and the disgraced La Jolla cop.
Mm-hmm.
So in Rick, in investigating, finding these the gun and the bullets and the empty shell casings,
mm-hmm.
he starts looking at cold cases around the time of his father being a cop, thinking maybe there's some connection then. And he finds there's only a couple people left from that are involved
mm-hmm.
in this cold case. One of them is an ex La Jolla police detective, and the other one is a newspaper reporter. And the detective has got a gatekeeper. It's his daughter, and she doesn't want anybody talking to her dad. Turns out he has cancer, and he's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Whether he has other reasons or not for not talking to Rick, you'll find out. The newspaper reporter actually opens Rick's eyes to some things he didn't even know about his father. When he talks to him, Jack Anton. I can tell you how the name Jack, this is a semi-interesting side story, the name Jack Anton came about.
Mm-hmm.
I needed a name for, Peter Stone shows up, I needed to have a license plate, vanity license plate that I thought would work for him. So I went on Facebook,
mm-hmm.
some people have read my books, and I said, I will put a name of, I'll put your name in this book if you can give me a good vanity license plate for Peter Stone. And so my sister actually ended up coming up with a good one. Out of all the Facebook things, my sister was the best. It was PR, PWR, and I think BRK or something, Power Broker, which made sense for Stone to have a vanity license plate like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, I'm not going to put your name in there. And she goes, well, put my son's name. Her son's name is Jack, but the last name is not Anton. She said, well, put his middle name, Jack Anton. So I had, that's why the newspaper reporter's name is Jack Anton in this book, because that's my nephew's first and middle name. Anyway, he's too young to read the book.
I always wanted to be a character in somebody's book, and one of the authors, the book's not published yet, but she made me bad. She called me Francesca Lewis, the horrible blank blank book reviewer. And I'm excited. I can't wait for it to come out, because I really want to be a character in somebody's book. Seriously. I've made people characters. And I really, there are a lot of authors that say, if you give a huge donation to this charity, I'll put you in my book. They should just put me in there for doing all these book reviews. Seriously. But anyway.
Generally, your name's going to go in there. It's often as a bad person, or you'll be a dead body. But Jack is a good person, and charity auctions, there is the name of the bank manager is actually from a charity auction at a writers' conference. Yeah, and she doesn't die, and she's a good person.
Oh well, I want to be the real person. I don't want to be a dead body. Please, no. This Thursday, the great and wonderful Dennis Palumbo will be here with Head Wounds. So if you want to read something about a statistical murderer, and he'll give you up and give you nightmares, you want to read that. It was great. Next Thursday, when I was looking for like a third person for this, I'm doing a show with an author whose son died from opiates, KTNBs, and Michael Embry, who's a reporter. And we're going to talk about opiates and what happens when doctors prescribe too many. And that's something I can join in on, because I won't take any of those. I mean, I was offered them when I had my surgery recently, and I said, I'll take Motrin. I won't take any of that. On the 13th, we have the author of The Shepherd's Calculus. It's a little sex in the Vatican. On the 15th, we have No Theory Like That, and that's about a girl who goes to purgatory to be taught a lesson she'll never forget, but will she come back out? I can't tell you that. On the 19th, I had technical difficulties when I was interviewing John Vanderslice for The Last Words of Oscar Wilde. The book is fantastic, so I'm redoing the show because the last 30 minutes, couldn't hear him. So I bought a new phone for that particular reason. On the 21st, Book of Lovers. On the 26th, New York Times actor Vincent Zandri, The Detonator. Said explosive. And on the 28th, to end the month, who better than Ryan Freeman and The Voice Inside. And yesterday, lo and behold, out of nowhere, I got an email from Philip Margolin. He's doing the first one in March on his book, The Third Victim. He said, oh, wait, did you get my book? I go, no. He said, you will. And I'm excited about that. So who do I got besides Matt Quayle? Boy, what can a girl go to have so much fun? So
you are very busy.
I have got 26 shows all the way to May 1st, and what happened was Ocean View Publishing sent me by R.Z. Belsky yesterday's news, and I private messaged him. I said, you got to come on my show. This book is too good. So that's the first one in May, and February is filled, March is filled, and April is just about filled. Would you believe?
Wow.
I know. Partners in Crime is what I work. I do a lot of stuff for them, a lot of their shows, and for that they did my blog tour for my new book, A Daughter's Promise, which I'm very proud to say won cover of the year last year. And is up for, I hope I win book of the year. That would be even better. Forward Reviews is looking at it for book of the year. And if I get an honorable mention, I'll be surprised. So this book is about power, money, greed, and land control. And Rick loaned something about his father at the end. But will he ever come to terms with his father and what he did?
You have to read the book to find out.
Okay, that's good. I was going to say that, too. So before we close, we have another – we have 10 minutes. Good. If Rick's father was alive today, would he feel differently about him? Would they get along?
I think that Rick would wish he'd treated him differently at the end of his life, or near the end of his life, regardless of whether he was good or a bad man. Rick's a pretty stubborn guy, and he didn't treat his father too well at the end, and he would feel he would good or bad, he would change that.
Well, I'm looking at the last page. I'm not going to give it away. That's what I will. But yeah,
okay.
Would they bond? I mean, would he still remain? You know, his father drank a lot too, something I don't believe in. So would they bond, or would he still remain the drunk that died a quiet death? You would hope that they, you know, my cousin died last year, and her sister hasn't spoken to her in 30 years, and when she died, they still didn't speak to each other. So I don't know. How do you feel about somebody that doesn't speak to someone, and then they die? It's kind of hard.
It's sad. It happens. I know it happens, and you never know. Life doesn't. Tomorrow is not promised. I'm certainly quite aware of that, and I wish we could all get along better, familiarly, what have you.
I agree with that. I agree with that. I mean, I even called my cousin called me before she died, and she said, please don't tell my sister I'm sick. And I have the auspicious job of, on June, the weekend of June 8th, of sprinkling her ashes over her mother and father. And that's the first. And it's kind of like I had to promise that I would do that, and her son's coming up, and I've never done that before. But it should be interesting, and I'm going to plan a service, so we'll see. So how would you define, you know what? I did my mother's funeral. I did her unveiling, so I think I can do this if they really want me to. So blood truth, what does it mean to you? There were two different definitions. What would you say the definition of the title is in this book?
Well, it does sound like a gory title, but it's not. It's Rick's, so in some ways, his quest to find out if you're doomed by your DNA to be his father's son in ways he can't control, because he feels like he's been going down a path further and further away from lawfulness in some ways, and he wonders if he is indeed his father's son, are we doomed by our DNA, or can we make choices that pull us away from our predetermination? So that's part of that, part of the whole blood truth. And in the end, he finds out if he was indeed his father's son in ways that are unexpected.
Now, before we close, the ending leaves more to come. What's coming next? I'm not going to say what the ending is, but that was an unusual ending at the end. That's all I'll say about that. You got to read it because you won't believe it. So what's going to happen next for Rick? What trouble is he going to get into next? And is it going to follow where this book ends?
Well, I think everybody dies in the end, don't they? So I think Rick's dead, and that's the end of him. I'm pretty sure.
I'm looking at the ending of it. It looks like
No, the end is so here's one thing I want to wrap some things up in this book, and obviously with his father's situation, I do, because when I write the series I'm writing, there's always carryover from the book before, and I wanted to have as minimal as possible, although actually there is carryover from something that happens at the end of the book. But so Rick is on his private eye, as book five starts, he's a PI, and he does jobs because he needs money. So he's been hired by a radio station to try to find out who is somewhat stalking, in maybe via mail or telephone, their top on-air star, who's a megastar compared to everybody else in this local radio station. So they really need her on the air. And Rick takes the case to try to find out who is stalking her. But in doing so, he finds out that she has her own past and things she wants to keep quiet. So when things get kind of dangerous, she doesn't want the police involved for her own reasons. Mm-hmm. So Rick is stuck with making some decisions. And of course, sometimes he makes the wrong ones.
Well, if he if he made all the right decisions, then it would be boring. And if there's no conflict or drama or something in the book, then I would just say, "Oh my God, it's getting too easy." That wouldn't be believable anyway. So where can everybody find out about you and your work, and when am I getting the next one before it comes out, seriously?
Well, I'm at my web page is mattcoylebooks.com. I'm on Facebook. Friend me. It's, you know, just Matt Coyle. You'll find me. I'm on Twitter to retweet things because I'm not smart enough to figure out Twitter.
I am.
Congratulations.
I have no choice.
Occasionally I'll post something, but I do know how to retweet. My next book, the title, I think we're going to go with it, is Wrong Right. And
oh, nice.
I just turned it in. I just got the edits back. So I think the arc will come out probably around July-ish, I would think.
Oh, good.
So I'm sure we'll get you an arc. Yeah.
Oh, without a doubt. So my last question is, are you coming to the Thriller Fest?
I'm not going to Thriller Fest, unfortunately. I'm not. I would like to, but I'm not going to be able to make Thriller Fest.
Oh,
I will be going
bad.
During BoucherCon, of course, in Florida. But
that's too bad. You wouldn't get to meet, guess who? Because I'm invited every year.
Well, congratulations. You're an important person.
Yeah, well, Kim invites me, and Kim Howe is coming on my show. I just finished Skyjack. Oh, is that fantastic. I read it in, like, Zap Time, and she's coming on my show April 26th. For those of you that didn't pre-order it, do it now. And if you didn't read all of Matt Coyle's books, I would suggest you get started now. Seriously.
I do, too. Me too.
Yeah, I'm going to put I'll put the review, the good one, back on Facebook. And I put the links to your book, to your book on Facebook just before. I did that also. And
thank you.
If you ever decide, I'm going to be, my next book hopefully will get done soon, I hope. It's called Katie, A Survivor's Story. It's my grandmother's story in a concentration camp. Being,
wow.
It's sad. And Partners in Crime, Providence Books, I hope will do my next tour because I do all their reviews and all their televisions, all their interviews. So they were very kind and generous last time. So I hope they do it now. But I want to thank you so much. I appreciate this more than you know. And for those of you that want to know what happened yesterday, I'm not telling you. I was just under the weather. And thank God the weather's better, and I'm much better today. And I really appreciate it. And I hope that when your book comes out, you'll schedule another interview after it comes out again.
Love to. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for coming on. Everybody have a great day, and bye.